This is Larry Hancock, General Director at Opera San Jose, and welcome to Opera Talks. And this time, Opera will be talking about La Boheme. With me today are Brian James Meyer, who's singing Schaunard, and Colin Ramsey, who is singing Colline. We've been in staging rehearsals for 3 weeks, and tonight we go into technical rehearsals in the California Theater, and we'll have four of those, and then a couple of dress rehearsals, and then we'll be on stage. And we will be on stage from Saturday, April 15th, for a run of six performances, closing on Sunday, April 30th. Gentlemen, you both have surprisingly beautiful voices.
Surprisingly.
I promise you, when you walk out and open your mouth, it's always a surprise. You have surprisingly beautiful voices at such a comparatively young age. Both of you have very natural, charismatic presence on stage. It has been a real joy to experience your performances at Opera San Jose this season, and for Brian, several past seasons. And I hope I will continue to have the privilege to hear and see you on our stage for many seasons to come. You were two of my favorite performers who have ever worked here. And I'm so looking forward to this La Boheme. So, Colin, let's get the weird stuff out of the way.
Sure.
You have a really mature sound. I mean, as a bass.
Yeah, yeah.
And for a kid, what, you're 27?
27.
And to have a voice like this at 27, it's kind of like Cesare Siepi.
Well, the funniest thing was when my voice dropped when I was in, like, fifth grade. And so it just, like, overnight, seemingly. And I would call my friends to, you know, say, oh, like, let's go out and play baseball or something. And I'd call their houses and I'd say, hey, is Ricky home? And the parents would freak out for a while, because for the first, like, 2 months, like, they didn't put two and two together that my voice had changed, so they assumed some, like, very strange old man was calling to, like, play baseball with their kids. And but that got out of the way. It's a nice thing, but it's also, you know, has its challenges in career.
I'll bet in your youth,
yeah,
it was a real adjustment. I mean, you weren't even, fifth grade, you're in grade school.
Yeah, I was a total weirdo.
Yeah, that would be tough. But it also, I can see how that would lead you into an operatic career.
Yeah.
Because the most outstanding thing about you at the time was probably your voice.
It probably was, but I played sports, I did lots of other things, and then
Yeah, but so did everybody
else. I didn't start singing until my senior year of high school, like, seriously. I did choir, but I did choir because there were girls in choir, and we got to go on field trips, so I was very... Such noble beginnings.
Well, that's what happens when your whole body is awash in testosterone in the fifth grade.
Exactly.
So there it is. Brian, you studied in Las Vegas, and that has always been a thing for me,
yeah,
because you were such a finished performer, and one expects to hear Manus or Eastman, or you expect those kinds of things out of a singer who walks on stage so perfectly prepared to perform. What happened to you in Las Vegas?
You know, it's in the water in Vegas. It's the showgirls and the Jersey Boys and the Broadway shows. No, I don't know.
It was Cher.
It was Cher. It was Elton John. I never actually thought I would be a stage performer. Even when I got into college, I was studying not to be an actual singer. And I recall after I had transferred from Boston back to Vegas, I briefly studied to be a mechanical engineer, which didn't work out. But when I came back to study music, I went into the choral director at the university and said, you know, I'm going to enroll in choir and I want to study to become a music teacher. He said, okay, well, you know what, what kind of, you know, would you like to audition for other choirs or other ensembles or other things, or the opera? And I said, no, I'm not really a singer. You know, I'll just be here and be in the classes and everything, but that's not what I, you know, that's not my focus. And he still tells me every time I run into him, he brings that up every day or every time and says, I remember when you came into my office and said, I'm not really a singer. And it wasn't until my first opera that I had to be in order to keep my scholarship that I realized it was a lot of fun and I actually really enjoyed singing. So
the opposite happened to me. Yeah. When I was in my first opera that I had to be in because of my scholarship, yeah, it was Goro. Mm-hmm. And it was a student orchestra. And they hadn't been taught by a fine conductor yet. the guy was coming mm-hmm. from England the next year. He hadn't arrived yet. And I was just fine. It all the way through, it was all happy days until the first orchestra rehearsal. And we were on stage up, going to open that week, right? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure out what key they were in down there. I was like, where am I going to find my first pitch? You know? It just scared me to death.
One of the first violins has it. Just one of them.
And I really, man, I didn't want to do this at all. It scared me to death. And I never overcame that ever. Hmm. I always, when I went on stage, there was always somebody, of course, these are student performances, right? Mm-hmm. There was always going to be somebody out there who I knew was going to give me some stupid curveball. I was on stage once, and some singer started singing recitative to me that was in the second act, and we were in the first act. And it was like, how do I retrieve this and get it back on track and get her where she needs to be? It was just too much responsibility. I would throw up before I ever went upstairs to be on stage.
Well, even in the last one, in Silent Night, we had one of the guys fall off a bunker flat on his face in a performance.
No. Yes, yes.
I didn't see that.
Yes. Good.
You played it off well then.
Yeah, it was somehow we survived that.
Well, things happen.
Exactly. Yeah, things happen. That's the point.
Well, there it is. So here we are with La Boheme. First of all, I think it's one of the greatest operas ever composed. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think not so. At all. You could not understate it. I mean, it's, you know, you couldn't overstate how great a piece it is.
It's just phenomenal. And yet the academicians tend to poo-poo all of Puccini, but I think they're crazy.
Genius.
The best. Yeah. And perhaps, I occasionally think, it's because he arrived at the same time that the film industry was born. Mm. And he was composing in a style sort of adopted from Wagner a little bit, where the music itself coming out of the pit was underscoring stage action.
Right.
And that hadn't happened before. Mm-hmm.
And just at the beginning of the 20th century, too, the center of the universe for film was in Italy. It was Rome.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And so it was very much, I'm sure, around him into, you know, the whole silent film era, actually, was dominated by the Italians.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
I knew about the French, but I didn't know. Have you guys seen the Lillian Gish La Boheme?
No.
No.
When Lillian Gish is still quite a young thing, because she started in the film industry at, 12 or something. Mm-hmm. She was lured away from New York to Hollywood by offering her the right to produce anything she wanted. She could produce, direct, and star in anything she wanted. And she picked La Boheme. Hmm. Hmm. And her first day on the set, she walked around, saw people. They were just touring her around, so she saw people acting. And she said, I want that one, I want that one, I want that one. And she picked her cast.
Wow.
Just walking around.
And it was developed from both the Puccini and the Leoncavallo scores. Mm-hmm. So there are scenes in it that we don't know much about.
Right, because Leoncavallo includes, I think, the Viscount. He has some business with that.
He has a trip to the Bois de Boulogne.
Yeah.
And that's where Rodolfo actually gets put in his place by Mimi. Mm. And he completely succumbs. And I think his name is John Gielgud, but whoever the guy was, that was an actor. Because what happens on his face in that moment, he goes from being just this typical guy trying to get laid to a father, a brother, a lover, a husband. Mm-hmm. All of it just washes across his face while he's looking at her. Mm-hmm. It's stunning. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the opera, they replay that as a memory while he's seated beside her bed and she has died. Oh. It's stunning.
That's good.
It's stunning. I recommend you see it. I have a bootleg copy that somebody from Los Angeles gave it to me because they heard me giving a lecture about Boheme. But it doesn't have the right soundtrack. The real soundtrack is both the Puccini
and
Leoncavallo scores. So that's what's underneath it. And of course, performed by, I should tell my friend Andrew Bales that he needs to do this because he's doing all these famous, I don't know if it'd help or not. He's doing the Harry Potter things. I just saw that last Saturday. Oh. And he did all the Lord of the Rings things.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so the film is showing up there.
Symphony
in the
Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Oh, they could do the Bohem film with the Bohem. I gotcha.
And have the real score. That would be phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on the huge screen, like it was intended. You know, those early films, like at Radio City Music Hall, there it was on a screen so big that it could be, you know, 15 feet across you from eye to eye, and a full symphony orchestra underneath, a big, like a Mahlerian orchestra underneath.
Yeah.
And that's what was going on for the premieres of films in those days. Gosh. But anyway, if you have the chance to see the Lillian Gish, I recommend it because it's stunning. All right, enough of that. So we have messed with our La Boheme. In La Boheme, who are you guys? Schaunard and Collina, your best buds.
Yes.
And as Rodolfo and Marcello are best buds, and the four of you are best buds together.
Right.
Buddies for life. And I think a great deal of what makes La Boheme so popular is it's not just a love story. It's not about a guy and a girl. It's about four guys and two girls. Mm-hmm. It's like a combination of Friends and Big Bang Theory. And
yeah, it's like the original sitcom, like, friend comedy. Yeah.
and everybody loves each other very much. And, of course, the world was, at that time, completely fascinated with the Bohemian movement.
Mm-hmm.
And something people don't understand, who were the Bohemians? They were the precursors of the beatniks, of the hippies, of the punk rockers.
Yeah.
It's that part of society that feels creative, that doesn't like what's going on in the creative world. They want to do something different, and they throw away standards of dress. They always throw out sex codes.
Mm-hmm.
They want freedom. Right, so those are the Bohemians, and the Bohemians made a huge impression on the Parisians because of Henri Murger and his
Scene de la Vie Bohème.
Yeah.
He was just writing columns for the newspaper and then collected those and made the book,
right?
Scene de la Vie de Bohème. Did I get that right?
Yes, great job.
They tell me my French accent is good, and I tell them that I'm an American and I don't have a clue. So, that fascination with Bohemians is a big deal. We, at the time, we no longer have that fascination.
Yeah.
We don't know even who they were. Americans, we just don't have a clue.
We have this romanticized idea of who they were, and we have Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, exactly. <You know? laughs> Yeah, it's not actually the way that they were. And of course, like, the Murger starts in one place and Puccini takes liberties with, you know, many things. Like, he combines the characters of Francine and Mimi to create his Mimi.
Yeah. And he cleans up Rodolfo big time.
Yeah, Rodolfo's a little bit more of a rake. He's not really a rake.
In the original, Rodolfo doesn't, which is actually Murger himself,
yeah,
doesn't even go to be with her when she dies.
No.
She dies in a public facility. So Puccini really fixed that up.
Yeah, he figured out how to make everyone a little bit more sympathetic.
It wasn't true to life so much.
I think one of my favorite jokes, though, in the Murger is that Marcello, in the opera, the opera opens up and he's painting the Red Sea, this painting. And in the book, or in the stories, he's always trying to sell the Red Sea, and nobody wants it because it's crap. He just keeps trying to sell it to people, and nobody will buy it. So he's like, you know what? I'm gonna redo this, and I'm gonna change it to Napoleon crossing the Rubicon. And so he changes it to that, and still nobody wants to buy it. That, like, there's this kind of running gag through the whole thing that Marcello is a terrible painter. Which I like the idea for the opera that they all respect each other's work to some degree, but I do think it's kind of hilarious, the notion that, like, you know, Rodolfo's writing a hat magazine, you know, on men's hat fashions, and Marcello is, like, painting this crummy Red Sea painting for, like, four acts, and he can't get rid of it.
Well, I've a great deal of what was true, and I grew up in the hippie culture, right? I mean, I had hair down to there. Everybody thought they were an artist of some kind. How many bands were there? I mean, every person you knew was singing in a band. I was even invited to sing in a band, which I didn't do. But it wasn't art. That was the hard part. It was crafts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It wasn't art. People did lots of creative things. We tie-dyed our T-shirts, right?
Yeah.
Everybody had embroidered things. Everybody was stringing love beads. But what it was a complete rejection of the people who had come before us. That's all mm-hmm. it was. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in every generation, to some degree, well, not every generation, but often, we get for a generation or two that kind of, we're going to go this way now. But high art is a whole different animal. And that takes a long time mm-hmm. and a lot of effort and real determination and natural gifts. It's a big combination. And I'm beginning to think that the natural gift part of it is not even half of the requirement. I've done this 35 years, right? And I've seen people come through here with astonishing natural gifts. And
yeah, it's one piece of the puzzle.
Right. It's one.
Exactly.
And I've seen people come through here who are fairly mediocre, who have international careers, mm-hmm. traveling the world mm-hmm. as singers. And they make a good living. They're not starring anywhere, but they're working all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because they were absolutely focused, determined, willing to do the job. Mm-hmm. They know what the job is and they're willing, and they were not ever delicate. They were never the people who came to say, oh, it's too cold in here. Oh, where's my scarf? Oh, I need some. None of that crap. Oh, I didn't sleep well last night. No, they were there. They were there on time, and they did what they had to do. And it may not be their best day. So what? They were there doing their work.
Yeah.
And tomorrow, it'll be a better day.
Yeah.
And it is, right? Yeah. And those are the people who you see them all on that wall out there mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. are singing Turandots around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And never once was it some little delicate creature who was worried. So that's a big deal. I think that's the greatest part in any career. I'll bet you could name just any career. I think that is the thing, that being able to be relaxed about it, focused on it, and just dogged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what gets you through. Mm-hmm. And you may not be Joan Sutherland. You might be Lucina Mara. But guess what? You're going to work longer than Joan Sutherland.
Yeah.
And perform more often. Maria Callas, when you saw how many... Maria Callas was performing as few as 12 times a year.
Yeah, it wasn't much.
Yeah.
And the top salary at the time was $1,000 a performance. $12,000 a year in the 1950s and 60s.
Well, she did more concerts and things like that, too.
Yeah, but on the opera stage...
Yeah.
That's about all she was doing. And she was the world's dominant performer. I mean, as far as we were concerned, mm-hmm. right? In the opera world, she was the world's dominant performer. And stunning. But she depended on somebody else to have some money.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not about having the most terrific, spectacular gift. It's about having enough of a gift that determination can make it
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
This is the wrong talk. I'm easily distracted, yeah. especially in the morning. Yeah. So, at any rate, La Boheme. Well, we've messed around with this La Boheme just a little bit. I realized that everybody who is in La Boheme, including the director and the conductor, had also been in Silent Night.
Actually, yeah.
Except for Sylvia. And yeah. Sylvia was supposed to be.
She was right. supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I looked at that and I said, my goodness, mm-hmm. every single one of them.
All the guys.
Yeah, all the guys.
Yeah. All the important people.
All the best people.
They've all yes, been in.
Thank you, Brian.
And that got me to thinking. And I thought, and then as both of you know, but the public doesn't know, this young man auditioned for Opera San Jose's summer clinic for young singers, which we're going to do again this year, 18 to 28. Auditions are this Sunday for that. A young blind man came in and we looked at his resume and discovered that he had sung Colline. And I had performed not just one time in my life, but many times in my life with blind singers. And for 4 years here in San Jose, while I was going to school and Patty McGinnis was going to school, she lost her vision during that time. It was slowly coming, but now it was finished. She didn't have vision anymore. And I worked with her on stage a lot and in a lot of different venues. because we were performing out and about a great mm-hmm. deal in those days. And Patty couldn't see. The audience never knew Patty couldn't see. She absolutely looked like a seeing person on stage. Yeah. We just had to do the right thing. If you put sheet of paper down that she was going to have to pick up, you put it down within a quarter of an inch of where it belonged.
Mm. Yeah.
And you did it every time. And the audience never knew that Patty, the conductor knew Patty was blind, but nobody else knew.
Yeah, talk about a good way to be able to set your own tempi.
Yeah.
No, maestro, you'll follow me, thank you.
And we tended, Patty mostly sang Mozart.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. It was never an issue. And this young man, one of the gals who was hearing auditioning singers, she said, "I see that you've sung Colline. How was that for you?" And he said, "Well, it wasn't bad, except that we changed venue at every performance." And when I learned that, well, that made me mad. Because I have a great sympathy for a person stuck in this position, right? And this is a tall, handsome kid with a low bass baritone mm-hmm. voice, rich, good sound, real potential as a singer. But I'm going, every time Colline's not easy.
There's a lot of business.
Yeah,
there's a lot of business. And he said, and one time they had to go from place to place in the room on a catwalk to get from one act to the mm-hmm. next act where the set was set up. Mm-hmm. He had to go across this catwalk to get to the next place. And I was angry. Of course, I wasn't there. They probably accommodated him in every possible way, and he was treated like Jesus, you know.
Aww.
But in my mind, I thought, that's cruel. and I sat. It was on my mind. I couldn't go to sleep that night. I stayed angry, and I sat up like 2:30 in the morning and said, if I were going to have a blind Colline on my stage, I would set it in 1918. The first Christmas after the war, and Colline would have been blinded by chlorine gas. And then I didn't sleep the rest of the night trying to figure out what would you do in this moment, what would you do in that moment. And I thought through the whole opera and said, this is possible. You could do this, and you don't have to change anything. There was one thing that I thought had to be changed that you guys didn't have to change.
Oh, yeah, we worked around it.
Yeah, the Bordeaux. That was the one moment that I said, if they would just change, he would sing it first instead of the Colline. And then I proposed it to the stage director. How about? And of course, we couldn't do it because our costumes were 1830s. Mm-hmm. And then I mentioned it to a touring group of Phi Beta Kappa who came here for a rehearsal and take a walk around and look at stuff. And they wanted me to tell them the stories of all the operas because they didn't know they were Phi Beta Kappa. Mm-hmm. They were not a music sorority. And I got to La Boheme right after Silent Night, right?
Right.
I said, and this is what I would do given my druthers. And finished telling the story and said, of course, I can't do that because our costumes are in the 1830s. And Clint and Mary Gilliland stayed behind after everybody left. And Mary said, well, I'd like to help with the costumes so that you can do it in 1918. And to my astonishment, she meant to pay for a new set of costumes, which she did. That's a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so now we have costumes in 1918, which is a spectacular period for clothes.
Yep.
It's a lot more fun. I mean, the guys are in sweaters.
It's like kind of when we did Where Angels Fear to Tread, it was that same time period, and the clothes were... Everybody looked really great.
Yeah. They're great. And Musetta's clothes, everything has fur trim.
Hers is good.
Cuffs, and all these insets and all this embroidery and all this. It's the time of Erte. It's the time of the Ballet Russe. It's Pavlova. It's Nijinsky. It's Coco Chanel.
And I think
Stravinsky.
We have all of those people on stage,
Picasso,
actually.
A whole bunch of them are, yeah. That was the great charm of it, is that who's at the Café Momus? Well,
Seth
Coco
Rogen.
Chanel and Stravinsky, who were having their love affair, right?
Yeah.
So they're all also at the Café Momus.
So keep your eye out.
And I have a lot of trouble with this Café Momus or Momus. You have to make up your mind. Are you going to say it in Italian or are you going to say it in French?
It's like kind of a weird mix of the two.
Yeah.
We do Momus.
Momus, Momus. But you sing Momus?
Momus.
Yeah.
So you do the you, but you also put the S because...
Yeah, but in a lot of French names,
you would say the S.
They do that, yeah.
Well, anyway, you guys have been now having to deal with the fact that you have a blind man on stage, even though we don't have a real blind man on stage.
No. I can see.
We were organizing it. Did they show you the dark glasses?
Yes, we have the...
That were sprayed black so you couldn't see out of them?
Well, yeah. We've gone through... I broke one pair of glasses, which I receive endless flack for.
Yes.
And
then your second pair was beautifully rhinestoned.
Bedazzled.
It was bedazzled.
I love them.
But then one of those bedazzled jewels fell out and you refused to wear them again. So
I walked out of the rehearsal. You did.
You did. So now you wear mirrored sunglasses.
I wear mirrored sunglasses. I wear my mirrored sunglasses. You look like
nothing.
The Fly is what came to mind when I came to rehearsal. But, have you seen the actual sunglasses?
Yes, we finally got the actual glass. I went in the other day and I said, I would really like to have the actual glasses just so I kind of know what I'm dealing with. And so we have those in there. They're, you know, the round... Sort of, I don't know. Like I hate to say, like
Harry
the round
Potter.
Blind sunglasses. Yesterday. Yeah, I wore them at the to the room run, the design run.
Okay, I thought you were just being weird, but
that I found another pair of sunglasses. That when I'm like every day, I'm going out and buying a cheap pair of sunglasses. But I wouldn't put it past me. But yeah, we did that. It's been a process. I mean, it's always a lot of work to get everyone on board with something like that and to make. You know, even little things like, you know, if I'm looking for food on the table, like in Act Two, when we're doing all the food stuff, I can't just say, oh, I'm going to reach over here and grab like the lobster. Like someone needs to help me like find the specific things.
At the cafe, that would be true, yes. At home, that would perhaps not be true.
Not as much. Yeah. But, you know, as we're like unloading things from boxes and whatever, it's always I always need someone to kind of help me get through that stuff. And it's not even so much that, you know, if I was actually a blind person, I would probably be able to find my way through things a little bit more. But I think a lot of what we're doing comes down to not breaking the illusion. Because the worst thing would be to, you know, be going along and everyone believes it. And then all of a sudden I like look right at the conductor or I like I'm sitting there and I just like look down at my cane and I pick it up and I get up and then I blind walk myself out. Yeah.
You simply don't look down. You reach down and pick up.
Exactly.
Your cane.
Yeah. So like it's the trick is never breaking, letting that slip so that, I mean, and of course it would be, you know, most people wouldn't notice it. But like the three or four people in the audience who were looking at me at that moment would be like, oh, he's not blind. It's faking it. So I don't want that to happen.
But. Well, it's an extra burden, but it did something for me that I cared about.
Yeah, well, and it's been a good challenge. Like I think we've created some really nice moments with it.
I just wanted Shonard and Colleen to be more present in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really bad about this. It seems that I always like the supporting characters more than the leading characters. It's true for me. In The Lord of the Rings, who do I like? I like Sam Gamgee.
Oh, well, yeah. Sam's the best.
He's my guy.
I like Merry and Pippin. Those guys are my homies.
Yeah, those are my guys.
That's Shonard and Colleen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They literally are. Yeah. Can we do that? Can we do The Lord of the Rings while I'm next?
So I'm always in love with the supporting characters, and I don't really care much about the principal characters. Yeah. They always seem uninteresting to me. They're always worried about their love affairs. And I don't care about love affairs much. So I just wanted the and besides, I think you two are such wonderful performers. The idea of sending you out there to be second stringers just galled me. And I wanted you to be prominent. And well,
Brian,
I also,
you should have sung Rodolfo. God.
Next time.
Yeah.
And I also wanted the deep friendship between all these men to be clear to the audience. And this is a wonderful way for everyone to be able to see that everybody steps up. And it's also a little reminder that these men have just come back from a world war that was vicious. And it's not all happiness. It's not all okay. But I didn't want, you know, wounded soldiers all over Act Two, you know, begging on the street. I didn't want that. So
it would be weird because we were so excited to go there in Act One.
Yeah. There's all these, like, I mean, the funny, I'm actually casting it out of the chorus in my head right now, and that's maybe the best part.
Yeah, there's a few standouts.
Yes.
So, but at any rate, it helps to underscore for audience who've become a little jaded about this work, to remind them what it's really about. And I'm a great believer in the camaraderie that comes out of war. And I've always been, I was leaning toward that long before because of this film called Restrepo that then was released as a book called War. And it was about guys in Afghanistan. And it was, this was journalism. These are people who were embedded filming these people, these young men live out there being shot at 24 hours a day. What that was like and how close they became and how tight they were. And then I started obviously having to prepare for this World War One thing. And once again, it was the thing that was blowing me away was how tight people became in combat units, how they know that their very life depends on these other men and these men's lives depend on them. And it's a closeness that it's not paralleled. There's nothing like it. And I thought to bring that energy to Boehm, these guys have been finished with the war only since August. So it just struck me as a way to help the audience understand what friendship really means and how hard it is to accomplish. And I think it's very difficult to accomplish real friendship in the world today. We're very mobile. We travel all over the place. My dearest friends are scattered all over the planet. And I don't get to see them. And it's a different world. We live in a world that is a little bit bereft of deep friendship. We have 1,000 acquaintances, 700 Facebook friends.
Yeah.
All these.
It's never been easier to
connect,
keep in touch, but it's never been harder, I think, to actually really get to know people in to have meaningful relationships.
To be available when they need you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the trick, right? And I grew up in a time when none of this stuff was available, and I didn't even own a car until I came to California. We were present in each other's lives on pretty much a daily basis. We ate meals together, and it was a wonderful closeness that these young men in Paris have.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to see it. And I think the verisimilitude is so right in this opera because Puccini lived through it himself. He himself was the Italian version of the Bohemians, right? The Scapigliati. Yeah. And he dressed badly and all that kind of stuff.
And he sold his coat.
And his watch and other articles of clothing and still couldn't pay his rent. Even after he sold it all, he still couldn't pay his rent and went hungry. And the salt cod, that happened. That was not in Murger. That's Puccini's life. That got inserted because it happened to Puccini. And that's what they had, these four guys. They had one little salt fish, and they called it a meal. Of course, our guys kind of play with the fish.
I think we've also got a bigger fish than they would have had for the prop.
So, at any rate, that's what mattered to me most of all was the closeness of these people, how much they depend on each other. And I love the idea that when Mimi realizes she is going to die today, and she gets up and goes to that apartment in her night clothes. She doesn't dress. She just shows up in a slip and a shawl because she was not going to take the time. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think of that. I just thought that was brilliant.
Well, her re-entrance in Act Four is like the most sort of like absurdly dramatic thing. Like in my mind, I always imagine when Musetta comes in and narrates, when you actually like envision what's happening, she's crawling through the streets, like coughing blood and dying. Musetta's like walking by and she's like, oh, who's this? Oh gosh, it's Mimi. And then she's like picks her up and carries her to the place and she shows up. Like there's something so like absurd about the how dramatic that is.
One is juxtaposed by what's going on in the apartment,
yeah,
which is this cacophony of, you know,
they're just it's laying around like, big time.
The
most raucous, like, 30 seconds of opera.
The way that we do it, which I really enjoy.
Me too.
It's pretty crazy. And actually, I find that that is a big challenge moment for me to not, I mean, I know what's going to happen at the end of the opera, mm-hmm. as does probably the entire audience, you know, and everybody
that's what
else
makes
in
it
the
so
entire
much worse.
World. But that's why it's so hard is to not immediately, when Musetta walks in the door, go to that place of, well, now, because if you are already playing that she's dead, then the show's over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's very, very hard to bridge this really, really high energy and fun moment with what is going to happen at the end of the show and make it a gradual sort of descent rather than a total drop off.
And my sense is that Schaunard actually loves Mimi more than any of the rest of them.
Well, in the way that we have, you know, the way that Michael Schell and I have sort of talked about Schaunard's character, everybody is really, everybody else is really trying to keep it together, particularly mm-hmm. for Rodolfo and for Mimi as well, and to be as happy as they can around whatever situation they are. But Schaunard is just petrified the entire time because he is the uplifting energy in the group, you know, and Musetta as well. But among the men, he's the big performer. Mm-hmm. He is comfortable in front of people, and so he's always high energy. And so for him to be on this high, in this high space all the time, and then all of a sudden to see reality is very, very, very traumatic for him. And so he doesn't really know what he's mm-hmm. doing and how to handle any of it.
And he doesn't move from her. That's why Collini has to come to him. He sits beside Mimi's bed and he won't leave. And everybody else has something that they get up and go do, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but who won't leave?
Yeah.
And Collini tells you, come on, get out.
Yeah, of here. I mean, that, and that moment is such a, I mean, you know, Collini deciding like, okay, I'm going to sell my coat. I'm going to do something, you know, something, because that this is all I've got. And basically to go to Schaunard and say, dude, the only thing, you know, I'm doing this, you need to go. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to leave
them alone for a minute.
That's what you can do to give them, you know, to contribute.
And I had always imagined a line that is not spoken. It's not in the opera, but I've always imagined that there's this line where Schaunard tells Rodolfo, I'll be right outside the door. Mm. He doesn't. It's not there.
Yeah.
But guess what? When he hears a little problem going on, man, that door is open and he's in the room.
Yeah.
So clearly he's gone outside and he's seated on the floor right beside the door.
Yeah. Well, and often, you know, I think in the stage directions it says that, you know, in Puccini's suggestion, that Schaunard grabs the water.
The water, yeah.
Which sometimes we get the water, sometimes we don't.
Well, I'll get it every
time.
You
get it every time. But sometimes we forget.
I've forgotten
a
few times.
Yeah, that's always, that moment is always a little chaotic because we're worrying about other, you know, so many other things there. But that, you know, you go and you get the water and you sit outside. And I think I've seen, is it the Met production where you can actually still see him outside?
Oh, I don't know.
Sitting, I think maybe it was a production that I did
someplace
once.
Else, not the Met.
Yeah, no, it was somewhere else I did it where Schaunard takes the water and he goes and you could see the staircase outside the garret and he just sat down outside with the water and waited, which, I mean, would kind of suck to just have to sit there for that whole scene, yeah. But it was a good image.
That's where the guy sits and bam, right in the room. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why I wanted so desperately to find a place in Act Two. Then there is no place. I wanted Schaunard to see Mimi in Act Two.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time since the war, they see each other again. Mm-hmm. There's just not a spot.
No.
I've combed it.
That act is pretty airtight.
I've rubbed the ink off the page. There is no place. Mm-hmm. The only way to do it is to make Schaunard simply pay no attention to Rodolfo and say, yeah, he has no girlfriend. Oh, fine, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to be doing something else altogether and have his back turned. And then when Parpignol enters for Schaunard to turn around and then see, oh my God, it's Mimi, right? And run to her. That's the only way to do it. So it happens during the Parpignol scene. But that's kind of contrived. So we had to abandon that. Because we don't want anything to look phony.
No.
I just hate it when you paste. It was Terry Teachout who wrote the libretto for The Letter, Paul Moravec's opera. And somebody in the audience was asking, the pre-performance talk couple of days before the opening. And somebody said, is this going to be one of those concept operas? Of course, it's a world premiere. So
in that way, yes.
And Mr. Teachout said, oh, you mean where the stage director smears peanut butter all over the score?
Yeah.
This really stuck.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always wanted to do the Planet of the Apes Rigoletto.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have a whole concept for Carmen, but that'll be on a different day. It involves me as Carmen.
Wendy starts selling tickets.
Yeah,
would be a whole different opera for sure, for sure. And that's I have this problem. I go to opera for the same reason that many Americans go to opera today, and it's been taking me a long time to figure out what's going on. Because operas that have been enormously popular in the past, terribly important operas, mm-hmm. like Manon, like Werther, like Evgeny Onegin, these are operas that the world has loved for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And now it's hard to sell tickets to them. If you're going to plan one of those things in your season, you have to do Butterfly, Traviata, and The Barber of Seville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can do Manon, and you won't go out of business. But you can't do two of those things. And they're the lowest single ticket sales we've had in the history of our company are those three operas. And they're terrific, wonderful they're great operas. Pieces. And that's when you think back, how did Americans get their opera in the recent past? From the Met radio broadcasts. Mm. They didn't see anything. Mm-hmm. They couldn't understand the language. They were making mm-hmm. up the story as they listened to the music, if they were making up the story.
And if they were listening, they would get a certain amount of narration, right, in between the acts.
Right, yeah, this is what's
kind of
happen
like, this is act, what's but... happening, and now listen and figure it out. Or right. Sit with your libretto if you're really into it and follow along.
Or if you got opera news and they would tell you the synopsis, right? You could read that and see some pictures, but you had no clue what was going on. Mm-hmm. So you just sort of read the story. And then you heard the singing. So music opera was really coming to almost all of America because mm-hmm. there were literally, when I was born, there were two opera companies, two producing opera companies in the nation because the Great Depression had wiped them mm-hmm. out. So we had the Met, we had San Francisco, since San Francisco was born during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. But there were only two. So if you were not going to one of those two cities, you didn't get to see opera, except the Met toured seven cities, I think, in the East Coast, Atlanta, and some other places.
Yeah.
So you didn't see it. So music came to you, opera came to you only as music. Well, that's not true anymore. And now people want out of the stories in opera, the narrative of everything. Americans want a hero. Mm-hmm. We need somebody, male or female, who is brave, who undergoes whatever the hell gets thrown at them. They don't break, and they would die to preserve the goodness that they think they're defending. And I think that's one of the reasons Butterfly is so popular in this country, but not mm-hmm. popular in other countries, because she has all the qualities. Mm-hmm. And Bohème has a great deal of this. And when you look at the ones, Traviata mm-hmm. has a great deal of this. But Werther?
Well, and again, as well, too, it's a very introspective, as is Werther. Mm-hmm. You know, the action is more psychological rather than physical.
It's so Russian.
And
it's so Russian.
We struggled with it when I did it. You know, we had two operas at the company that I did it at, and we did Macbeth, which is very physical. There's mm-hmm. you know, witches casting spells and, you know, trees moving kind of, and, you know, sword kind fights of. And all kinds of stuff, you know. And then we did Onegin after Macbeth, and for a lot of us it was like, what's happening? What's going mm-hmm. on in this opera? You know, we knew, but outside of the core, you know, of three singers, basically Lenski and Onegin and Tatiana, you know, everybody else is just kind of
dressing
along with their lives. Yeah. And that's about it. And that's hard to get into unless you really, really, really know the story or the language mm-hmm. or the music or any combination of the three. But if you're just going to an opera and not knowing anything about any of that stuff, then you would hope that the production value is high enough.
And the singing, those two things. It's like if the singing is really great and the production value is really great, then people can get into it. But if you go, if you go to see Eugene Onegin and you've got like boorish Onegin and a Tatiana who can't really do it, what are you doing? Like that, of course, that's it's just terrible.
And on the other hand, when we first opened as Opera San Jose, those were operas we could do. We could mount those operas. So we did them. And guess what? We sold tickets to those operas. Yeah. I mean, Sandra Rubalcava sang a spectacular of Menel. It was great. Mel Ulrich was a wonderful Onegin. These things all happened. But man, now it's you. And I've started asking people because I would like to bring these great masterpieces back because they're great roles for you people, right?
They're
just great roles. And I'm just going, why won't you come to see them? And they said, there's no one in them to like.
Particularly Onegin.
Onegin's tough. And I think Onegin, I mean, certain operas also have like cultural barriers. Like Bohème somehow like gets over all cultural barriers. Like it's an Italian opera about French bohemians, you know.
Because it's at its core, it's about friendship.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas like Onegin, there's this like kind of suffering that's so like life is awful, like kind of a Russian feeling.
It's all internal.
And it's all about making the wrong choices and it's just, so that piece in particular, I love it. But
lost opportunity.
Queen of Spades too, all that, like a lot of
Olga's, I think, the most exciting character in Onegin. She's the only one that's like, I want to be free and laugh.
And everyone's like, go away. Go away. We're getting back to the sad part.
So anyway, I'm so glad we're doing Bohème.
Yeah.
And next year, we're going to be doing Così and La Rondine. The only time we've ever had an encore at Opera San Jose that we just couldn't, because we didn't do encores, right? Mm-hmm. But we, on the opening night of Rondine in the California, we'd been around for a long time, right? We couldn't proceed. The audience would not stop. They would not let us proceed. We had to repeat the second act choral finale of Rondine.
That's a good bit.
That last big quartet with the chorus, right? Mm-hmm. They wouldn't quit. So the conductor just didn't know it. So he said, okay, go back. He was indicating to the orchestra, go back. And then everybody was on stage was going, go back to where?
You'll figure it out.
Just jump in.
Yeah, when that music starts, you'll know where it is. But nobody was in the right place on stage, you know. So everybody sort of had to adjust, and we sang the second act finale again. I love the opera. I've been reading, why on earth do people think it's not good? And it was because instantly the kind of music that Puccini undertook started being copied in commercial music, operettas. They instantly started doing it. And just like Puccini's music became film scores.
And Cats and however many other... So, what's the Andrew Lloyd Webber that steals like from Fonciulla incessantly?
I think it's the one about the guy with the mask on.
Is it Phantom? Phantom is like 85% Fonciulla del West.
So I don't know if it's that much, but yes, there are definitely quotes in those shows from the Puccini.
Foundation successfully sued him.
Because it really was just lifted the tune right out. But at any rate. These watered down versions that come to us not from the genius who created it, but from the copycats, suddenly all of it gets denigrated.
Yes,
including the source material. Well, we've lost that stuff. We don't have those operettas now, so the Puccini's work can shine on its own, and we're not comparing it to the waltzes that we've heard because Rondine is filled with waltzes.
Yeah,
just as Traviata is filled with waltzes. And nobody poo-poos that. No. But Verdi's arias were called organ grinder fodder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he would have.
Well, I heard this story about La Donna Mobile where he refused, that he closed all the rehearsals for Rigoletto he wouldn't let, and nobody could sing the tune. There were like all these like agreements because he didn't want people to be going to the opera and hear the organ grinder.
Because the gondoliers would take it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't want them to say, oh, he just heard it from those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's a rumor or not, but the orchestra didn't get the parts for it until the day.
Yeah.
The day
that's right.
Or something.
But it wasn't hard for them to play.
Yeah.
And indeed, instantly, all the gondoliers were singing it.
Overnight.
But it started with Verdi that way.
Yes, so memorable. At any rate, well, gentlemen, we've gotten very far afield from La Boheme, and I've dominated your whole morning. And thank you for getting out of bed and coming down here at this ridiculous hour of 10 a.m. I didn't know there was a 10 a.m. I know there's one at
beautiful.
The
It is beautiful, end. Yeah.
Actually, I'm lying. I was already at the gym at 8.
Yeah.
But at any rate, thank you for being here. So glad you're in this opera. It's this is exactly the energy, the age group, the everything to make Boheme the most perfect thing it can be. And I'm just so happy to have you in our company.
Thank you.
We're happy to be here.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.